Hello, it is December 20th, 2016. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 625 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. I know. It's been nearly a month since we've done a podcast. The holidays have gotten away from me a little bit. Some larger writing projects. Also, I've been working on my own other podcast with Tim Grierson, the Grierson and Leach podcast, which we do a weekly movie podcast, and I produce that, which is why it doesn't sound probably as good as this podcast does, because Danny Wexelman and the crew at MLB Advanced Media know what they're doing in that regard, and we thank them to that every week. But I apologize, it has not done a show since the Jeb Lund show for Thanksgiving. We're going to fix that in 2017. Come on. Did you really want to listen to a lot of podcasts in the wake of the election? Anyway, took me a while to get back in the game. Anyway, but we are back. This will be the last show of 2016. It's the regular annual show with Tommy Craggs, who's now the politics editor for Slate and one of my favorite people in the world. We always have a good time wrapping up the year chatting with him. But we'll be back with Allison Futter. We'll be previewing the NFL playoffs and college football playoffs. I'll be at the championship in Tampa this year with Matt Brown, so I'm sure I'll talk to him there. We'll have a lot of stuff to discuss, but mostly I apologize for the delay. We'll be right back to it regular starting in 2017. But for now, as always, remind you to please review the podcast on iTunes. Please don't mention, sometimes I go a month without a show, because we'll be back to normal with that, I promise. Of course, always the music is by the Sundogs and so on. But mostly, I'm very excited to have for my yearly chat with Tommy Craggs. All right, Craggs, first off, thank you, as always, for you save, I believe, your yearly podcast appearances for me. We spend the first 10 minutes before we get on the call, like everybody does anytime they do anything with Tommy Craggs, which is trying to talk Tommy into realizing that he has plenty to contribute to this conversation, and we want to be able to have this call. So thank you for doing the show once again, Tommy. How you doing?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me. I'm doing well.
All right, thank you. All right, well, listen, this has been great. Have a great holiday season. So you are, last year I talked to you and we went through the TikTok of that whole mess. I feel like we have happier things. For those of you who literally know nothing about the news business, nothing about Craggs at all, and the last thing you heard was that, it's been an active year for Craggs. You've been the politics editor at Slate. When did you start?
I started in March.
So when you started, you had done some stuff for Slate in the past. Because this was also a year that I kind of dabbled in politics a little bit, I think in a different realm than you, and I think with different results. But I had started like mid-summer of 2015, and I had this idea like, hey, it'll be a lark. I'll do politics. I'll write about something serious and important for once, gag. And that's not what happened at all. So I'm curious generally, by March, when you took over this gig, what is the gig? I saw you did some writing, but are you mostly just working with the writers? Where was everybody's headspace in by March when at that point Trump had won, had almost won Iowa and had won a bunch of states in a row, and this was starting to get going a little bit? What was your mindset going in? What, as someone that was kind of, you know, coming into this insane election already that was only going to get more insane, what was your mindset and the kind of goal of what you wanted to do in being in kind of taking that gig?
Well, since I am, I guess, also a political dilettante, which is something I had read about and written about, like mostly through the prism of sports, to, you know, a great many Deadspin readers' chagrin.
Sick the sports.
Yeah. I'd never covered it. I'd never covered a campaign, never covered policy or anything like that. So mostly my goal was to not trip all over my dick, And just like get out of the way. Like Slate had, Slate has a great political team and has a legacy of great political writing and political coverage and campaign coverage in particular. So I knew that if I just stayed out of the way, it would be fine. So I went into it hoping, I had a handful of smaller goals, but I went into it with that, you know, I didn't go into it thinking I had these big plans of shaking things up.
Well, how long did you stay out of the way?
What I found was it was sort of impossible to, because shit was happening that there just, you know, there wasn't precedent for, and everybody was kind of flying blind. And so it was, you know, my job as editor to figure out how we were going to cover this unprecedented thing. So yeah, it didn't last long. I mean, I'm trying to think back when I came on, I think at that point it felt like, had Iowa happened.
And then his kind of, remember, because Trump lost to Iowa kind of close. And then he kind of got the ball rolling and started winning a bunch.
Yeah, it felt like at some point the bubble was going to burst. The Trump bubble was going to burst. And so that when I came on, it was like, that was, you know, my expectation was that would be, you know, kind of the first big story to cover. And obviously that didn't happen. Yeah, and on the Democratic side, I probably was, I don't know, by the end of the primaries, I think I found that there were more people sympathetic to Bernie Sanders than I had thought when I had started. But I was, you know, I went into it wanting Slate to take him seriously, and Slate had been somewhat dismissive, not you know, not terribly so. But I had wanted us to cover him a little more seriously than we had, and I think we did.
So one of the things I'm curious, just from obviously your background doing this and my background doing this and all this, is one of the things that's really I find myself thinking about a lot is you ran Deadspin, which is a site that, as you know, a large part of that job is just dealing with online dipshittery, and kind of the way you and I have had many discussions in the past about how much kind of like how much Deadspin's role and how much like the web's role in this stuff and covering all this stuff has changed over the years, and how it used to be just, you know, cute Brooklyn girls writing in a little box and making jokes, and then it became this kind of social thing, and then it became, you know, you know, dealing with assets of the internet. One of the things that is really amazing to me, regardless of everything else that's come around with Trump, is this idea that, you know, you for years, and I less successfully, have tried to like bring perspective and try to bring truth and some sort of intelligence into the world. And I have to say this, forget, even if Hillary would have won, I think I would have had a hard time keeping faith in all of that.
Oh yeah. I mean, my mantra since the election, and I said this so many times that some editors here finally said, like, shut up, you have to write this if you're going to keep saying this. My mantra has been that journalism is useless. And I have a hard time shaking that thought. I mean, the whole enterprise, you know, the thing that the field we thought we were entering, the thing I went to school for foolishly, was premised on these, like, you know, on the idea that there are these certain shared assumptions about, you know, the values of a liberal democracy or whatever, and the role of journalism within that liberal democracy. And the election was like a pretty good repudiation of that idea, that there are these like shared, not only that there are these shared values, but that there is the value itself in the idea of a liberal democracy. And I've, you know, the thing I a couple days after the election, I went to talk to a class at Columbia Journalism School. And it was an arts journalism class, and I was still very, very depressed and,
yes,
and angry. And this was really my first contact with people,
oh, man,
like outside of Slate, really. Like, I had slept at the office on election night.
Did any of them even have any hair left? Any of those poor students?
But I started talking, and I just, like, you know, I was talking to, you know, graduate students, people, and a lot of these people who are people, like, mid-career people, too. And all I found myself saying over and over was, if you care about changing the world or changing the country, get out of journalism. Like, right. Go run for school board somewhere. Go run for office somewhere. Go get a friend elected. Like, the best journalism, the best political journalism was thrown at Donald Trump. Like some of the most aggressive, sharp elbowed stuff was thrown at Donald Trump, and it didn't matter. And if you want to change, if you want to change the country, you're not going to do it, you know, from, you know, a website or a blog or whatever. Go run for office. And I still think that. And a part of me, like, every day I wake up and I think I'm a coward for not following through on my, you know, own advice.
Do you think this was, do you think this was a consequence of Trump, or do you think this was always veering in this direction?
Oh, no. I mean, Trump is the great culmination, right?
Right, like that's, right.
It was, you know, in retrospect, it was inevitable that something like this would happen. It just, I don't think anybody could have expected it would happen so suddenly, and it would all coalesce around
that guy.
Like that guy. Yeah.
Right. So, do you think that, I'm curious, because one of the things I asked my question, which I think is, I found myself, one of the things that I think has been really hard for, one of the many, many things that's been really hard for people since the election is the, like, obviously it's been depressing because of all the horrible things that are going to happen. There's that. But even if, I feel like by the time the election had come, even though I felt like Hillary was going to win, and I took my son to lunch, and there was like, there everyone was wearing Hillary shirts and dancing to Katy Perry, and everyone was just, you know, everyone was Jell-O Pops, and it was all a great time. It's still, even with that, it felt, it's not like that election was fun. It's not like that election was joyous. It's not like that election was, even if Trump would have lost, I don't know if that would have been any sort of vindication for journalism, I guess is the point.
Oh, yeah. There. No.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess that's the question, though, is because I think you've got to something I find myself thinking about a lot, which is there is a thing that I always say when people try to do the journalism is dead or journalism in trouble thing is, listen, certainly the economic model has some things that needs to figure out, to say the least, but there is more great journalism happening now than any time that I can remember. Now, there's a lot more junk, of course, but there's also great stuff. And we saw it, you're right, about this campaign, there was so much good stuff in so many good places, all over the place, good writing, good thought, good, all sorts of great stuff. And you're right, it was all, by the end, particularly by the last month, it all seemed to be just channeled as a laser beam right at Trump. So on one hand, I think that was people kind of recognized the moral hazard of how close this was coming and how ultimately it turned that way. And I felt like they needed to all go after him. On the other hand, this is a version of the debate that you and I have been having for a long time. Isn't that also part of the problem? The idea that there seemed to be some part of the problem, it's not an equivalent sort of thing, but certainly if you are one of the people who believes reflexively that the media is on some sort of opposite side, the fact that the New York Times, one of the greatest newspapers in the world, in the line of all this, where you've got Michael Barbaro, who's, I think, a terrific reporter and a good guy, but basically every single time I would look at him on Twitter, he would be raising his hands in the air, jumping up and down, saying, please do not elect this man. Please do not elect this man. And all of this was all channeled in his direction, to the point that I wonder if that itself, it became easier to ignore because all of that was, as opposed, like, none of these stories could land because everyone was all just shooting them all at him at once.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the David Fahrenthold stuff was otherworldly. You
right,
know,
the
Access Hollywood tape had a material effect on Trump's polling. Given what happened after that, it just became part of sort of the wallpaper of the election. But, you know, that found an audience, and that, you know, that said something about Trump that actually, you know, softened his support in significant ways. I don't want to get into the sort of Nate Silverish, if the election had been held the day would have happened. But, there is good evidence that that had a material effect on Trump. And Fahrenthold in general is, you know, there is a counterfactual here in which, you know, Hillary wins and we all breathe a sigh of relief and journalism doesn't feel so under siege. And we can look back at what Fahrenthold did. I think there is like a really interesting, like that is a really interesting triumph because, you know, he was a guy, he essentially blogged, he blogged his way into the biggest scoop of the election.
Right, right.
And he did it in this, like, you know, this iterative way, right? He started as, he kind of made himself into an expert on, like foundation and charity law, and kept poking at that and wound up with a number of significant stories, none of which really seemed to land, partly because, the idea that Trump was a crook had, you know, was, you know, widely known and by some people embraced, you know, the idea that he's a crook, but he's a crook for us and not for the other side.
Right.
But because he had planted his flag in these kinds of stories and in this kind of like oppositional, antagonistic, not unfair, but antagonistic reporting, he wound up, you know, I don't know how he wound up with that tape, but my presumption is he had staked out this ground as the premier Trump antagonist in the press. And because of that, he wound up with the biggest scoop, which, you know, the Access Hollywood tape. That is a triumph of a model of reporting that I don't think really existed, certainly not in the mainstream press, even, you know, 8 years ago. Right. You know, this is, and obviously I have biases here and I come from, you know, Gawker, where Nick Denton used to preach this kind of iterative model. But like, if you look back at how Fahrenthold approached that beat, how he fashioned it for himself, you know, some of those stories, the art on those stories was like photos he had taken of his notebook.
Right. Right.
Like this was, he was a blogger. He blogged his way into, you know, into that reporting. And you know, if we weren't having this wholesale reckoning, you know, as journalists with ourselves and our purpose in life, and in a, you know, in the Republic, I think we would be like, sort of singing the praises of Fahrenthold and looking at exactly how he pulled off what he did. And I think that it would be a really interesting moment for journalism. Instead, you know,
yeah, that didn't happen.
Falling apart.
Yeah. Right. Now we're all waiting for the gulag. And
yeah,
so I guess that's, but again, it's funny too, because I guess this can transition that into a little bit too, because it feels into the Gawker idea a little bit. I mean, the idea that in the middle of the election, Trump had floated the idea that Peter Thiel was going to be his Supreme Court justice. It was a potential Supreme Court justice. There was something about, and I think we still see it. I feel like the coverage since the election has happened has been more, less outraged and more just bafflement. Like there's a certain impotence really to all stories now. Like now that we know that, oh, well, he won, then, yeah, like, oh, now what do you have to say? Like now what difference are you going to make? And
right. There's
something to that idea. But I don't know if I'm quite ready to accept that impotence just yet. And it always is difficult for me to handle. But certainly when, like, how do you get up in the morning? Like, honestly, how do you, are you kidding yourself? Are you just, I know that you're still doing good work over there, but is it hard? Like, how does this turn? Like, does it, or is it the idea that I find myself anymore, like, I can't imagine a story that would come out about Trump that I think would touch him. Like, I have to say, I've reached that point where you could have video of him, you know, having sex with a dog. And I don't know. I feel like he'd be bulletproof. And it's amazing to me that this guy is the guy that's figured that out. Is there a way for us to go? Is there anything to do?
Well, you know, wake up every morning hating myself. I mean, even before.
I was gonna say that was the case before. That's been the case since I've known you.
Now, yeah, it's like impotence is the sort of, that is the default feeling every day. The, I guess yesterday or a couple of days ago, I heard something that gave me some small splinter of a shard of hope. And this is like third hand, and I'm probably revealing something I shouldn't, but I'd heard that Michelle Rhee was going to be the nominee for education secretary. And somebody did their due diligence on her and found some of Dave McKenna's coverage right. of Michelle Rhee and Kevin Johnson right. on Deadspin. And that's that knocked her out of contention. And not to say that Betsy DeVos is any better, but, you know, that is the material consequence of a piece of journalism. That is, a huckster did not get a job she didn't deserve because of a piece of journalism.
So it went to another huckster who didn't get the job.
Yeah, another huckster got it. You know, that story mattered. And that makes me thrilled for, you know, for several reasons. But that's a story that, according to what I'm hearing, had an effect. And, you know, it's not going to bring down the Trump presidency. That's a blip. It's not even a blip. Nobody even knows about it, really. But and who really cares about Michelle Rhee in the end? But
it's something.
It's something. Yeah.
When. So I want to talk a little about Gawker, actually. A lot's happened since, obviously, last year we were talking about all of your exit from there. But in retrospect, you know, I think that obviously, you know, at the time, it was clear that what was happening to you in that situation was really about a lot more than just that story and a lot more than what was going on. And I think we saw the ramifications of that and the ultimate conclusion of that this year with the with all of that Gawker case. You haven't been affiliated with Gawker. I've been affiliated with Gawker in a long time, really long time. You haven't been affiliated with Gawker in a while. But obviously, we have many friends that work there. Our mutual close friend, AJ Delorio, was a big part of that's all been going on with that. As someone that had been there so recently, had such a major role, a much bigger role at Gawker Media than I ever did, what did you think watching this stuff happen, having everything happen with the fusion and all the sale and kind of the ultimate conclusion of all that and how the idea that the last thing that happened was then Gawker, or whatever the smoldering husk of what Gawker was, LLC, was threatening to sue Delorio over being in betrayal of his contract for doing the thing that, of course, was the central tenet of every single Gawker Media editor's job, always struck me as like, yep, that's probably how this was all going to have to end at a certain point, was everybody eating itself. What did you think kind of watching all that go down?
I mean, I guess my main thought there is that AJ is the real deal. You know, for AJ to press his appeal, you know,
and AJ has, you know, settled against, for those that don't know, AJ and the deal, they just settled last week. It was in Forbes had a thing about it. I was telling people that I saw AJ last week, and I was telling Craig before the call, he was literally holding his settlement in his hand. I was like, let's give it up to my Airbnb. I was in Los Angeles. So that is done. I don't think that is the end of the story, to say the very least, for AJ and this story, but certainly that particular nightmare that has been his life for the 4 years, that specific part is actually over. That thing is now settled.
And I know it's, I mean, I think maybe things have changed a little bit, but there was a point where it was, AJ was the most convenient villain, and to see a lot of,
well, they were looking for villains and they found the best one.
Well, and it wasn't just the Teal, Charles Harder, Hogan, axis. It was also fellow journalists you know, staunch First Amendment types who, you know, made AJ into a pariah, people who aren't a fraction of the journalists AJ is on AJ's worst day. And, you know, having worked with AJ on a lot of his worst days, like, I think I can speak from experience there. Like, yes. that guy took did the basic function of a journalist better than anyone I've ever worked with. You know, I've said this in other forums, but, you know, his allegiance is to the story, and he will run through whatever walls, it takes to get that story and put it on the page. And there will be, like, anybody who approaches the job as fearlessly and aggressively as he does will make mistakes and will look foolish. And a willingness to look foolish in public is a commendable trait for a journalist. It is practically non-existent now that being a journalist is in part performing virtue on Twitter or whatever. You know, I hope that AJ can get back to doing the same sort of aggressive journalism he was doing. And I know that's like, that is a horrifying statement for a lot of journalists, but I don't, I don't think people know just how great he is at that, and how necessary those talents are.
Particularly now.
Yeah.
So I agree. And listen, I echo every single word that you just said about AJ. But I'm curious, AJ, you've been there since AJ's been there. What do you think of the way that this landed with Denton kind of saying uncle and kind of moving on from it? I know there was some discourse, some discord among some of the Gawker staff, a lot of which came from the union thing, which you kind of helped put into place. What do you think of Gawker? Not so much like, I don't mean to make like a judgment of what kind of site they are now, but just the way that all went down. Can you be... You know, I love the work that just looking back at my old stomach guys, I love the work that Deadspin does on a daily basis. I love the work a lot of those guys are all doing on a daily basis. But it does that sort of essential fearlessness, not to say that it's not there, it's still there, but that fundamental let's break shit stuff that seems to be the foundation of the site, it seems like that would be more difficult, not just under the new ownership, but really under kind of the way that Denton was toward the end.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think that was the case. That was the case long before the verdict. That was the case, you know, and I didn't, my folly was in not appreciating it. That was the case. Even before I became executive editor, that was probably the case even before Gamergate, you know, that, the ground had shifted and, there just wasn't the appetite. I mean, Nick didn't have the appetite doing the sort of stuff that, you know, made Gawker vital. I saw that and I knew going into the job when I took it, that something was changing, but I didn't realize how dramatically things had changed, in his head and, just how, how tenuous the footing was, at that point. But yeah, this is something that, you know, this was a long time coming, and whatever, you know, chilling effect people feel now, like that had been descending, you know, long before Univision was sniffing around Gawker.
And I want to be clear about this. I really, like, I read Deadspin every day. I read, like, a lot of these sites every day. I'm a big fan of so much of the work there. But it does, I mean, it is. It does, it feels, it is different. Like, I mean, they're selling T-shirts with the go fuck yourself Trump tweet on it now, which is fine. It was a great tweet, but you know what I mean? Like, it does feel in a different kind of way. I'm curious in that kind of place. I mean, you're at Slate, you know, I mean, I think that you're doing great work over there, but do those places exist? Cause it feels like
it's gone.
Is there anywhere?
The dream is over.
But it's just like, this seems to be the time where it's needed more than any other time.
Yeah. I mean, I am a longtime defender of tabloid journalism. I don't think, Tabloid is a derogatory term. I think the tabloid approach is in a lot of ways closest to what the basic approach of journalism should be. It's like what I said about AJ. It's putting uncomfortable things on the page, by whatever means. That's just not a tenable proposition anymore. I mean, the successful tabloids now, it's TMZ and National Enquirer, both of which are compromised in every direction, which, they're whatever you see on the page, any incredibly vital or compelling story on the page is the result of some sort of negotiation. They broker their coverage for access. It's tabloid only in affect, but it is thoroughly corrupted. Gawker really was top to bottom, soup to nuts, independent tabloid operation, and you still see plenty of it. Deadspin still gets away with things that I think, by virtue of Deadspin's legacy and partly it's the people who know how to take they know how to take these risks.
Right.
Deadspin gets away with stuff, but I know just from talking to people there that it's not they can't quite do everything that they would want.
Right. It's not exactly the same, I guess that's wondering, is there any hope for that? Or is that like, it feels like, I feel like that kind of would have been done. That was done before the election. And I feel like the election was such a staggering event for a lot of people everywhere, but also in our industry, for the idea like, holy shit, like this, we could just lose everything now. But in a lot of ways, a lot of this stuff was lost before we got a guy in almost in office, I guess. We're doing this call around the time the electors are voting. I'm assuming they didn't turn it around, but in case that didn't happen, a guy who is actively anti-press. Not that Hillary was like this in the warm embrace of the press and come on in, but now we've got someone who is openly, not only hostile, but openly encouraging to sue journalists and to do that. But all of this was happening before this happened. So when you combine those two things, is there honestly any hope for the industry? In your opinion, or are we just kind of like all hanging on for scraps?
Yeah, I think we're doomed. The kind of stuff I got into journalism to do, kind of fractious, occasionally scuzzy work. Like there isn't an appetite for it anymore, and that goes for both. For editors and publishers, and to an extent goes for readers too. I will float across just old stories we did on Deadspin back in the day, stuff you did on Deadspin back in the day, and just it's just amazing to think that there was a time we could publish this stuff. A celebration of pure license or whatever. It's like we even when the site got big, we were free to be, a little daring and a little reckless, and to take the kind of risks that you have to take if you're going to do interesting journalism. And there is no taste for it anymore.
Okay, let's put aside journalism for just a second, because clearly it's dead. I don't even know how well. I'm assuming the checks for doing this podcast were not even clear. How about as a citizen? This is the thing that I've been working on a big story for New York about this idea of in the wake of the election, what just as a regular idiot walking down the street, what you can do. Do you feel like you, because we're all kind of trying to figure it out, right? You know, one of the things I've been noticing a lot of, I've been getting a lot of emails from just random people that I've never had any contact before, just saying, listen, I kind of feel like the world's a shitty, mean place right now. So I'm just sending random notes to people who make me at least happy for like 3 to 5 seconds every once in a while. Just like these random little, like, I'm just trying to figure out in this new landscape what to do. And of course, we've had some like give to the Southern Poverty Law Center and give to the ACLU and, you know, generally be nice to people when you cross the street. But to me, like, this is the thing that journalism will either find its way or it won't. But I find myself, and I think a lot of people are having the same issue, of in the wake of the way the world as it is now and the way it's, you know, it's just going to get worse in the next few years, what just as an individual we can do? Do you have this thought? Have you had this thought of, do you feel like being the politics editor of Slate can help, forget what it will do for journalism in general, but and whether you feel impotent or not, but just that basic thing is I find myself, like, I wrote this, I was on Fox News about a couple weeks ago talking about why the NFL ratings were down, and they brought up the Kaepernick thing, and I just kind of dismissed it out of hand as like, well, obviously it's not that. And of course I was flooded with people screaming at me and so on. So I thought the right way to do that was to not be like, okay, you guys are idiots, you're wrong, and just fuck off, jerks, but like actually try to, okay, let's explain why this doesn't make sense and why this doesn't work, and not so, and whether it worked or not, or whether it didn't, at the very least I was like, you know what, I'm giving everything a fair airing, and I'm not just like trying to get everyone into their corners the way that I think has kind of led to this point. This is kind of a big question, but like, what do you do? Like, do you feel that kind of despair, and have you just personally tried to figure out a way out of it?
Well, this is your longstanding fantasy, right. I mean, and I do think that one of the I'm not going to say healthy takeaway, but an important takeaway from the election is this: it's time for liberals to disabuse themselves of the fantasy that political arguments are a matter of shoving your pile of facts into an arena. And it goes up against the other side's pile, and you are confident that your pile is bigger and your facts are better, and that because of that, you will prevail in the end. Like that's like the basic premise of like Keith Olbermann, whatever he's doing at GQ, John Oliver. It's the idea that amassing these good facts and presenting them in this compelling way is a way of winning a political argument.
I know, and I understand that, and I understand the limitations of that, and I agree with you. But what's the other option?
Well, this is the crisis. Like, I got I thought like facts have value, and it's a way to win arguments, and you know, for me personally, this has been the thing that I've been saying. Like, if I actually give enough of a shit about the country, you know, the fate of the country, then I should actually do the thing I've been telling everybody else to do, and I should quit, and I should go run for office somewhere. Like that is the way to change things. I should go run for school board, run for city council. And I'm, you know, too much of a coward to do that at this point.
But did you go in journalism just to change things?
No, not to change things. But if the value of a fact has been so diminished that a figure like Trump could win, then, you know, maybe the idea that got me into journalism, that got my socks rolling up and down about journalism, that like, you know, that you could convey some sort of knowledge or whatever, you know, whatever that knowledge may be, but present some sort of fresh truth to people. I think that's been thoroughly devalued.
In perpetuity? Because, I mean, listen, these things have gone in waves. In the past, there have been times where I mean, I agree, and I think that's clearly the current state. But this is what I know how to do. So the idea that like if it doesn't work, fine, I'm gonna be penniless and broke in 15 years, and I'm gonna have to deal with that. But on the other hand, the idea that well, looks like it's harder to win those arguments with facts anymore. I don't know what to do other than that.
I mean, I don't think this is a liberal fantasy strictly among the journalist class. I think this is like
I'm not even sure it's a liberal fantasy. I think it's a truth fantasy.
Well, okay, but my point is, I think this is a problem, you know, in the Democratic Party. I think this is part of a problem. Some of the source of some of the problems with the Obama presidency. It's this faith in that the world can be solved through technocratic rigor and know-how and elbow grease or whatever.
Wasn't this the frustration with Obama's press conference the other day? The idea that he was still appealing to these better angels when there are no better angels.
Yeah, and it's more than that. It's like sort of an allergy to politics and like the grubbier parts of politics, which is just that, you know, it's the idea that politics isn't ideas. Politics is stuff, and it's giving stuff to people and selling the idea that you're giving stuff to people. And there is sort of an allergy to that. And this goes beyond just a sort of self-delusion of journalists. I think, there's an idea that policy will prevail upon its, on its own merits or whatever. And I think that's like some of the problems with Obamacare kind of turn on that idea, right? I think there was this idea that the merits of Obamacare would sell themselves. I was reading, I think it was a story in The Atlantic, and it was going through, kind of the history of antitrust, in the Democratic Party and just how kind of philosophy changed over the years. And there was a description of like flyers that Democrats used to hand out to rural voters in Texas. And I think the flyers literally said, "Here is what the Democratic Party has given you." And it was like just straightforward: electricity and roads, social security, that kind of stuff. And it was very straightforward. This is the stuff you've gotten thanks to the Democratic Party. And the election has sort of clarified to me that the further our political leaders get away from the idea that politics is stuff, the worse off we are. And so this has given me some, as an editor of some of the best political writers in the country, frustration with these kinds of things, I can express through my writers. Not to say that I'm they're sock puppets or whatever, but they get to say things that have been bugging me, and there is some, at the very least, there's some emotional satisfaction in that a lot of the rage I felt after the election, Jamelle Bouie, a lot of the rage and fear I felt, Jamelle Bouie could express, and a lot of my just sort of fundamental doubts about American democracy, Michelle Goldberg can express, and my rage at the Democratic Party, Jim Newell can express,
Newell's piece that got right around after the election, I was like, oh man, Craggs is that one's got Craggs' hands on that one. Newell's piece. I'm not saying that, but I was just like, yep, that feels like a like that. If that would have been other than there would have been more references to some of your personal peccadillos, I could have seen your byline on that piece.
The thing is, before the election, we were talking about Jim writing something for the day after. This is when we were operating under the assumption that Hillary was going to win. Jim was going to write something the day after saying look, we won, but things aren't so hot within the Democratic Party. There's no bench. Look at the state houses, look at the governor's mansions, et cetera, et cetera. And then when it was clear Trump was going to win, I think I just slacked Jim, like, welp. And he was like, I'm going to write that now.
Yeah, now's the time. Yeah. All right, so the last thing I want to talk about with you is actually a little bit more depressing than all of this. One of the great jokes that we did on your last day at Deadspin was I pointed out that of my last two book parties that I've had, you have shown up in the exact same Chicago Cubs shirt as your form of silent protest against me, and which I always appreciated. And I didn't even notice it until at the second party, my dad said, "Hey, I think your buddy Craggs is wearing the same shirt he wore last time." So I was like, then I looked at the picture. I was like, oh, what a dick. So first off, two questions. One, I think it's hard to argue. My longstanding premise has been held true, which is that if the Cubs were ever to win the World Series, famine, pestilence, and plague would immediately land in its wake. And secondly, as a Cubs, you know, Cubs adjacent supporter, which I would argue is the vast majority of Cubs fans anyway. I loved my great joke this year is when David Ross got the massive ovation in his last game at Wrigley Field, and as if he were like Ernie Banks or Ryan Sandberg or someone who had played his entire career in Chicago and there deserved the praise. And I was trying to figure out why are they praising this guy so much. And I realized, oh, right. Most of these people just started watching last year and they think that he is in fact a lifelong Cub. So as someone that I assume you as a diehard, beloved, hardcore Cubs fan just watched every game this season and just couldn't help but feel that when they won the World Series, this is the culmination of a lifetime of dedication, pain, devotion, finally being rewarded. Because that's what all Cubs fans had, right? All those people that were excited that went on Facebook and said, we did it, and screamed to the heavens. We're not saying the same thing about the Red Sox 10 years ago. And we're not saying the same thing about the Royals a year before. But we're, in fact, lifelong Cubs fans. Those were all those people, right? Confirm that to me, because I just assume that's true.
Well, first of all, I don't share your disdain for bandwagoners in general.
I know you don't. I know, because you're soulless.
Well, I feel like I have a really obnoxious opinion here that I don't know if now's the time to share it.
That's right. If it's obnoxious but will make me look better in reflection, please go.
Well, I think the idea of diehard fandom, mm-hmm. lifelong fandom mm-hmm. to a particular team, just makes you a tool of the ownership class. Mm-hmm. This is what they want. They don't want fans to be free agents picking and choosing which teams to root for. They want fans locked in and buying the replica jerseys and the replica alternates year after year after year.
I mean, I think that's totally true, but what does that have to do with anything?
I don't share your disdain.
Technically speaking, I could just go choose different parents if I wanted to. It would be much easier if I could do that, but I don't have a choice in that either. So... anyway, so tell me about your World Series experience of how happy you were.
The story here and what Will is alluding to, is that I was a Cubs fan all my life. Mm-hmm. And then after 2003, I dropped them, mostly because I couldn't stand the misery of it. The Bartman stuff, it wasn't Bartman himself. It was the way Cubs fans just sort of ate their own out of, you know, misplaced rage over that the Marlins series just made me think this is just like I didn't get into sports to feel unpleasant.
Yes, you recognize that the inherent cruelty of Cubs fans was something you can no longer tolerate. I understand. Move on.
Yeah, that's. And so I was living in the Bay Area at the time, and my friends and I were going to a lot of A's games. And so I became an A's fan. And originally I thought, like, this is okay. Everybody's allowed, you know, NL fans are allowed an AL team and vice versa. Some, I think you would dispute this, but it didn't feel like I was totally giving
it's
up
fair.
The Cubs.
Right. I don't agree with it, but I understand the mindset. It's not like you picked the Cubs and Mets. Like, yeah, I think it's
right.
A little better.
And then I got like, this was a really fun era of the A's, and it was fun to go to games. You could sit pretty much on your own, you know, in the upper level. You could go for $10. And so I became an A's, monogamist. Have not regretted it. Even this year, I felt when I started getting text messages from friends who were really excited and wanted me to share in their excitement, I felt like I was missing out. That was the only time I felt like I was missing out. Well, the games were great, and it was fun just as like sporting events to watch those games. That was a great World Series. I did not feel, until the text messages started coming in, I didn't feel like I had made, an error in giving up the Cubs.
My friend Mike Cetera, who of course is is the guy in the book, My Book Are We Winning, is a guy I go to the game with. My dad is a lifelong Cubs fan. I was actually in the press box at Progressive Field Game 7, and he texted me in the sixth inning when the Cubs were up 5-1 or whatever it was, saying this is as great as I thought it was going to be. And I, of course, screenshotted the picture, said nothing, didn't even respond to the text, but screenshotted the picture. And of course, when Davis hit that homer, in which I tackled poor Phil Rogers, poor Phil Rogers, formerly of the Chicago Tribune, a man I had never met and have no interaction with whatsoever, but I literally jumped on top of him, grabbed his head, and yelled holy shit into his ear. When Davis hit that homer, that is actually what happened. So I've not seen him since. I hope no one has told him. Like, maybe I should have said, I'm sorry, my name is Darren Rovell. I lose my mind sometimes. I will say, ultimately, obviously, as a Cardinals fan, I and my father, who I talk about this all the time, we have handled the Cubs World Series a little bit better than I thought we would. I found the two things that helped were, one, even the most hated a Cardinal fan that hates the Cubs and wanted them to be unhappy, whoever that theoretical person might have been, it's hard not to be moved by the people writing the names on the Waveland wall. I think anyone would be. That was a cool thing. Yeah. People, right? Like, it's, anyone would not be into that. And the second thing is that the fundamental foundation of liberal democracy was destroyed like a week and a half later. So that made it easier. So as I said, I told you the Earth was going to create off its axis and go crashing into the sun if the Cubs World Series won the World Series. And God damn it, that's exactly what happened.
I mean, you're right. The Cubs World Series is entirely about your inner life.
I know it is. I know. Exactly. That's what I'm trying to explain to people. All right, Craigs, you always get my socks rolling up and down. Thank you for coming on and chatting with me for our yearly conversation. I'm hoping to see you. I'm going to be in New York this week. Hopefully I'll get a chance to see you. My one request for you, Craigs, whether you end up chucking your good gig, giving good commentary, information, and entertainment out at Slate to the world, and decide to go run for dog catcher of whatever county you're living in now. Come back to my Illini. Come back to our Illini. I need to talk about the Illini with you. I still never miss an Illini basketball game, and I find myself, my dad can't stay up late enough for them anymore, so I need someone to watch the games with me. So please come back to our Illini. Right. Malcolm Hill will set you free.
Deal.
All right, Craigs, thank you as always. Have a great holiday season, and we'll do this again next year.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye, everyone. Have a great holiday season, great Happy New Year, and enjoy the end of the world. All right, be safe, everyone. See you in 2017.